That's a wonderful, wonderful collaboration. Marc Berthomieu from France and Régis Guizavo from Madagascar with a wonderful duet, Les couleurs d'ici, meaning the colors here. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. By the way, I just needed to let you know that, yes, the accordion can do things other than lady in Spain. It's Tuesday, January the 21st, and a South Carolina Circuit Court judge is being asked today to grant a new trial for a 14-year-old boy who was executed almost 70 years ago for allegedly killing two white girls in the segregated town of Alcolu. Even in 1944, there was widespread outrage that George Stinney, the youngest person executed in the United States in the past 100 years, was convicted and sentenced to death after a trial that lasted less than a day. Stinney's lawyers, aware that their efforts are a long shot, are seeking to clear his name with a retrial, even though the prosecution's evidence no longer exists. But Stinney's family say they have gathered new evidence in the case that will clear him. It's not certain whether Judge Carmen Mullen will rule today, but Stinney's supporters said that even if the motion for a new trial fails, they will ask the state to pardon the 14-year-old. Sad that this country has been so brutal. But today is, of course, Tuesday, and on Tuesday, the airwaves belong to you to raise those issues that you find very important to discuss among ourselves. And here we go. We have Harvey from Berkeley. How are you, Harvey?
Very good, Eutrice. And how are you feeling these days? You feeling a little better?
I'm hanging in there, despite the conspiracy.
Good. That's important. And, yeah, I think it's time to be a little lighthearted here. Well, of course, the Republican Party, they seem so strange. I have possibly a new answer to our dilemma. The Republican Party, they seem so strange to especially people, Americans, people who vote for them. And, you know, they cut food stamps programs, taking the food out of the most vulnerable of our men, women, and children. Many are disabled, elderly, the veterans. And you know, at the same time, we exported, in 2013, America exported $140 billion in food and agricultural products. In 2013. And at the same time, they cut unemployment insurance. And after shipping out a lot of the jobs and offshoring the factories, of course the Democrats were involved in this too. Yes, they were.
Very good. I'm glad you said that, because I was going to ask you about that.
And I feel it's rule by the cruel, and you know, their decisions are driving people into crime, into drug addiction, into prostitution, into alcoholism. And alcoholism breeds child abuse and malnutrition. I mean, they're going the wrong way. And I was looking, browsing the web the other day, and I saw this interesting article. It says, coming soon, America's first cuddle shop. And they're hiring. And if you look up those words, coming soon, America's first cuddle shop, there's a woman in Portland who's opened up a cuddle shop. She feels that there's a need for cuddling. I think also there's a very famous Indian woman who goes around and she moves from city to city and she cuddles people. She holds and cuddles people. So I think I'd like to institute a cuddle a Republican today. I think that they need cuddling. I'd like to see a congressional bipartisan cuddle. I'd like to see them all get together in the Congress and cuddle each other. And I think that this could possibly be the answer to this meanness, this rule by the cruel that we're experiencing here. They're out of touch, and we need to bring them back. And fighting doesn't help. I mean, they love fighting. That's their thing. They may have been abused as in their youth in some way. The rich get abused as well as the poor. So I say, cuddle a Republican today, and maybe we can make a better world here.
Thank you, Harvey, for that insightful proposition. Thank you so much. Clara, You're on the air. Clara from Philly.
How are you today?
Hello. Fine, thank you.
I also hope you're feeling better. I thought you were well, so I never said anything about it before. I'm sorry. Anyway, I'm calling. I want to make a comment about your series on the CNN Rothman situation.
Yes.
I don't want to continue it. I just want to make a comment. I just want to say that halfway through that three-episode series, I began to wonder what the point was. I mean, I got the impression that there was going to be a conclusion that would be of interest. But what I thought at the end was that your point was, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the media abuses black people. Was that the point?
Well, it does a number of things, including abusing people who are viewed as coming from constituencies that are unprotected, politically unprotected, or powerless. That would include African Americans, but it includes any group that are seen as coming from constituencies that are viewed as powerless.
Okay, and that brings up another thing that was on my mind. The parts that I know about were what you talked about, and they reminded me more of the Jerry Springer show than anything else. And I thought that, well, okay, that happens. What are we going to do? What do we do about it? Well, you know my answer. I don't watch it. I think we give it power. We give that whole sick, toxic atmosphere of cruelty. We add to it, I think, when we give it so much power. And then Eric, I think it was, from Brooklyn.
Eric is from Brooklyn.
He joined me, I think it was, in trying to bring the conversation over to another level, which is, what do you do? How do you manage this? How do you prevent yourself from being in that kind of position when it's absolutely unnecessary except for the financial gain? And when people go into situations unprepared, and we know now that he was totally irresponsible because he was drunk, unprepared for the purpose of making money, I don't think we have time to protect them. If he were on the street as a homeless person, I would be more concerned. I'd be very concerned. Because that person probably, in many cases, is not responsible for where he is. He does have some responsibility, but not the level that a basketball player would have. And I think that individual power, you said we've had no power. I think you agreed with the young woman at the end. We have power. It's individual power that we work on and we develop. But that then turns into individual personal responsibility. And I think that's what a lot of people want to avoid. They want to say, we don't have any power. Then you don't have any responsibility.
Oh, I think there is a combination of how these two things in the way people see it. When you say that people have power, of course people have power. And by the way, it is being expressed because CNN has not been able to get itself out of the ratings rut because people are leaving the station. They're deciding not to look at it. And Chris Cuomo's program, as I said, in 6 months alone, lost 33% of the audience. But CNN generally is losing audience share to a frightening degree. And the opposite of that is that Fox News has been number one for the past year and continuing into this year. So it means that there is something happening. What's happening? What's happening is that Fox News is holding on to that conservative element and building on it, but the people who are, quote, liberal, unquote, people who have a more expanded view, if I could say it that way, are seeking their information elsewhere. They are completely different in the way they obtain their information. And cable television generally is really going down, because the way consumers are obtaining their information has just been so fast, changed so quickly, that cable just can't keep up with it. So cable network news and other cable programs, news programs, will be suffering across the board because the audiences are seeking their information elsewhere. So, yes, that is an expression of consumer power, that they have made and are making entirely different choices about how they get information. But on the other hand, the media is also a socializing tool. Whether it's in print form or, you know, on the internet or whatever, however people access information, it's a socializing tool because it shapes public opinion. It shapes our attitudes. And when things shape your attitudes, they shape the decisions that you make. So that's the socializing element of it. So you cannot just unhinge the two. They are related. And in this case, that this medium as a socializing tool is socializing its constituency, its viewers, to perceive African Americans in a particular way by telling the story of Dennis Rodman and these basketball players in a particular way. They are doing that. That is incontrovertible, because you can see the culture of the organization stretched right across. No matter which program dealt with the subject, they dealt with the subject from the same vantage point. The idea is to destroy these men, and to make it impossible for them to thrive after this particular experience, because they committed the great sin. The great sin was that they did not ask permission to go, and they did not toe the line that was given to them, the assignment given to them arbitrarily by media people who themselves couldn't fulfill the assignment. Since then, what have we seen? And it's following exactly as I said. They were happy to report that Dennis Rodman went into a rehab center to deal with his alcohol problem. So, but they really want to tell the story. The story they really were hoping to tell by now was that Dennis Rodman was found dead someplace as a result of his suicide. That's the story they really want. They really want a physical destruction of this man. They want him dead.
I just want to say that there's another other side. Is his participation in it cannot be ignored or minimized. I think we're hurting ourselves when we continue to give passes to people because they're of a certain race or of a certain other ethnic group or because they're poor. I think that that happens a lot, not just in the black community, but in the American community. We give people passes for inadequacies and even criminal acts. And it's detrimental to society.
I agree with you there.
Time, but that's the way I see it.
I agree with you that he did have certain responsibilities with the way the story was told. He did have that responsibility. I'm not at all shying away from that reality. That is absolutely true. However, if I have to weigh who did the most grievous harm here, I'm real clear about who did it.
I'm not.
You're not?
When you participate in your own destruction, I mean, well, you are, that is really a very...
But, you know, that is, I could understand that, but I also have to say it this way. Dennis Rodman could have been there as, you know, as straight as an arrow. You know, he could have been dressed in the most conservative clothing.
Well, that has nothing to do with it, the way he was dressed.
He could have been literally as sober as a judge. Well, that's not true. I'm not many drunk judges, but he could have been forthright and dealing with the situation well. It still would have had the same outcome.
We don't know that. We really don't know that. What Eric brought up, the name of Muhammad Ali. I neglected
yes.
to. if you had been around when he was here, when he was in the public eye, you'd understand what I'm talking about.
Oh, no, I understand it very well.
The dynamic was working, but he always did it because of his intelligence.
But understand something. Muhammad Ali, apart from his personal power and presence and his, you know, state of mind, he was a very acute thinker. Muhammad Ali was also perceived as a person who came from a constituency you don't mess with. Muhammad Ali wasn't just Muhammad Ali. He was speaking with the strength of a huge constituency that backed him. So he was not, whenever he spoke, and even to this day, he is not viewed at all as a vulnerable person. He is viewed, even though, of course, his debilitation because of his disease, if Muhammad Ali says something, it is regarded with great respect because he came from and is supported by a constituency which represents political power. So nobody could mess with him. That's not the case with Rodman.
When he was Cassius Clay, people listened to him.
Because he was a person just the same from a constituency that was broad. He was, as Cassius Clay, still the black man in the eyes of the world, a very powerful black man. So he was not a vulnerable person. As Cassius Clay, he had the pedigree in his profession. He had an incredible wit. He was also of a community that was broad and that could revolt. I mean, people could, you know, they were very democratic. If Cassius Clay, as Cassius Clay said, hey, tomorrow let's vote Republican. I'm seriously thinking about it. Guess what? It would have had incredible impact because he had that power. Dennis Rodman does not have that. And so when the media looks at a person, they also measure to what degree they could get away with stuff. Would they suffer any grievous consequences for being casual? No. When you are preparing to do an interview with certain people, they would, I mean, straight up, they're not pulling any punches. But with others, outrageous conduct on the part of the media, as we saw with Rodman. But the idea is, is this person perceived as having the backing of anybody that can do us any damage? Is this person a powerful person, not only in and of himself, but by extension, does he come from a community that would come to his rescue or to come to his or her defense? That is a major calculation in how the media would treat a person. It is absolutely true. Thanks, Clara. Extraordinary contribution today. Really, thank you so much. Sarah, you're on the air.
Greetings to you, Yutrees.
Thank you.
Oh,
and to you too.
Yes, ma'am, and greetings to the PRN audience. Yutrees, I'm glad. I'm not going to touch on this topic that you mentioned with Dennis Rodman because, as you stated with Muhammad Ali, he had the backing. He was a very articulate young man. He came up, he had the backing. Plus, he had the Nation of Islam. He was trained under Malcolm X as well as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So his background was totally different than a Dennis Rodman, who is out here floundering and really didn't have any connection to the black community, so to speak. Whatever connection, it was tenuous at best. So he did not have that stability as a Muhammad Ali, a Jim Brown, or a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Those men had back in those days who know themselves and were very sure-footed. But what I was going to touch on, Yutrees, is the topic with Dr. King and this dream and this nonsense that has been pushed around here. And I listened to your program on yesterday and the speech that he made at Riverside Church a year to the date before his passing. And every year we get these same old fakes and phonies, these politicians, these black elected or selected officials who come out here and they do these sham. To me, if you are in any elected office, you shouldn't even be given no granted no seat at any of these Dr. King memorial at these churches or Ebenezer's and all these other places have done. I lived in Atlanta for over 20 years, and I have never went to the King Center. I went there once. I took my mother when she came to visit, and I took my mother-in-law when they came to town for them to visit. But me personally, I've never made it a point of going there because I feel they have desecrated the King Center. What they have turned that into is a tourist attraction, and it has nothing to do with reflecting on what Dr. King stood for or what it stands for. No, everyone wants to get up there, make political speeches, talk about run their election campaign from the pulpit, which is what they have done. John Lewis, C.T. Vivian, Reverend Lowry, you know, they have all allowed themselves to be coddled into turning this Dr. King into this caricature, into this Santa Claus version of a person that everyone wants to sell, this soft sell, and it is totally ridiculous. And we as a people, we need to step back from this nonsense and not allow it to happen. Last thing I'm going to say about this, and speaking of politics and what went on, the president and the pardoning that he has done with these eight young men who were pardoned, seven of them were black Americans, and one of them was a Latino of Hispanic origin. Do you know that one of the individuals who was pardoned is a first cousin of Deval Patrick? His name was Reynolds Winter Smith. He's a first cousin of Deval Patrick. He is from Rockford, Illinois, and he was a convicted drug dealer who was given a life sentence. So once again, we are seeing that if you have position and power, you can call in the big guns, because I know Deval, even though we know a lot of black people are incarcerated for all of the wrong things.
Well, you need to say who Deval Patrick is.
Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, the present-day governor of Massachusetts, whose first cousin, Reynolds Winter Smith, is being given this pardon. And we can see once again where nepotism, favoritism, where if you have connections to the president, you can write a pretty good, put in a few good words, working in the background, you can get these things to happen. So when people are seeing all these things and they're crowing about what this thing that this president has done in giving these pardons, you need to look below the surface and start digging to see what it is, because you try and shove them in there and camouflage them around these other people, thinking that you would not dig deeper and find out more information about these people who were given these pardons and their possible connection to him and Chicago as well as the White House.
Well, in that sense, he is a true Clintonite.
Exactly.
He's a true Clintonite in that respect. Bill Clinton pardoned a whole bunch of people, including on his very last day, people who include the father of his son-in-law. This is politics, and this is why people get so turned off. They get so disgusted with it, because no matter where you look, you know, people keep looking for some glimmer of hope that, yeah, this person is a principled politician. Not so at all.
Usually, as I said, the old boss is just like the new boss is just the same as the old boss. That's all that you've gotten, except this one comes with a smile, and, you know, and you could feel much more comfortable in taking your poison, because he's given to you it with a smile, and then he taps you on the back while you're drinking it, instead of holding a gun to your head and say, you need to drink up.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks
you're
for
welcome.
Being with us. Thanks a lot. Eric, you've been talked about. Eric from Brooklyn.
Hello?
Hello, you've been talked about today.
Yes, I love it. I talked about Clara the last time too, because we're on the same wavelength. I want to go back to that topic again, because I think it's so critical. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
Oh yeah, I think it's so critical that, you know, we really have a better understanding about power. You know, I think that, you know, just because the people who are oppressive are cruel doesn't mean they have power. And we see it through the history of, you know, during slavery, their brutality didn't mean they had power. They had a lot of fear, and that's why they turned to the tactics that they do. That's why peaceful revolutionaries, people that are not picking up any weapons, that are not throwing any bombs or dropping bombs on people, have so much power and instill so much fear in these people that we consider powerful. So in that sense, when we talk about power, we have to stop, you know, disempowering ourselves. And that's the main point that, you know, I think Clara and I have been trying to make. I heard a lot of people after the last, after the last comments that I made, who called in and talked about how powerless they were, you know, how powerless we were as a people, and I don't feel that way. You know, I don't feel that way. And this is what I carry through in all my jobs. You know, I've been fired from a lot of places because I refuse to be disempowered. You know, I refuse to be making money for people, and then they treat you like dirt. And too many people accept this. This is normalized as if you weren't working for them, would they be making money? Because they couldn't do the work. If it was, you know, the other way around, they could not do it. So we are powerful. Now, in Dennis Rodman's case and these 10 black men, the problem that I see with them is that they want to be a part of this system. So they're going around making the appropriate tour, you know, laying themselves at the feet of these people, and they're getting flogged. They're accepting it dutifully, you know, just so that perhaps one day they'll be like Kenny Smith or Charles Barkley on ESPN. Not that they, I don't think Charles Barkley is in that vein. But this is what they go. So at the end of the day, it's about money. This is why they refuse to defend themselves. So I don't want my son to see that. See, you know, 10, you know, powerful black men that they look at and, you know, they're like, oh, these were athletes, these were people that who made a lot of money. So is it because you're broke that you're making yourself available to be witnessed, you know, in this fashion? Or is it because you want to end up on that stage with the same people that are flogging you? And I think it's embarrassing. And I think, you know, CNN, Fox, they're sinking ships. So what are we going to do? Make them sink faster? I don't think that's the point. I think the point is to make sure that our people are educated enough so that when people are making asinine accusations and asinine, you know, comments regarding what your purpose is in North Korea, you can actually intelligently defend yourself and make them look foolish. I think that's much more empowering for you, you know, our youth, to see black men standing up for themselves, you know, and appropriately and correctly defending themselves. You know, it's a better image. It's better than us.
But Eric, we heard that from Charles Smith. Charles Smith was very reasonable, very intelligent, very contained, very confident, and kept having to repeat himself over and over and over again. So I'm not at all dismissing your point. Your point is very well taken, the same as Clara's. You make very good sense. People ought to have some understanding by now, considering, you know, their profession is all about, you know, dealing with the media. You ought to have a far more sophisticated understanding of media and how to deal with media. I'm not running away from that at all. That is absolutely true. In fact, that was one of the major things that this experience pointed out, that for all of the talent that they have and the space that they occupied and the, you know, broader scheme of things and the American psyche or the American social scene, whatever it is, they were not quite that. Well, I shouldn't say they, because we only heard from a few of them. Overall, it pointed to a need for people to have a certain education about how you deal with media and how you don't deal with media. By the way, these folks have representatives and agents. You know, that's an agent's job. I mean, I could tell you about a whole bunch of people who can't put two sentences together, but their agents are so effective that you think that they can. But I'm looking at what the issue here was. The issue really was the decision, a collective decision within media, which is an extension of the power structure, an extension of the power elite, if you will, and the decision that these men were to be destroyed, utterly destroyed. But why? Go ahead. Sorry.
It's self-destruction. Because how can you allow? I mean, you choose.
I understand that.
You know, self-destruction. I try to destroy you. How come? No. How come? And Gary, no. How come you guys have one of the biggest things going. That's the point.
But let me ask, let me ask you this. Let's put, let us put a similar treatment up on the board here.
Yeah.
Let me raise an extreme example of, say, Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah.
All right. All kinds of awful stories.
Yeah.
She's drugs and alcohol, and she's this and she's that. She's out of her mind. She's whatever it is.
Yeah.
But the media still report on her as a kind, with a certain amount of sympathy, a certain amount of humanity.
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, if we were to look at the parallels here, we see that in some instances, the media would choose, even as they report what is going on in her life, you know, the yes. latest court appearance or the latest automobile accident or the latest rant or rage or whatever it is she's into. But at the same time, they don't have that thirst. They don't, I mean, outwardly say she ought to be just destroyed.
But this is consistently the case. This is consistently the case. And if we depend on that media, like, for example, what if Dennis Rodman would have come to some other media? Why did he have to lay himself at the feet of these people? What about going to a media source like PRN that would empower you and reaffirm your humanity? You know,
yes, we could look at these problem. Things. You are correct again.
These arguments for these men to make. Now, the refusal to make these arguments, and then the spectacle of turning on each other in the way they did. Charles Smith, you keep saying that Charles Smith adequately, no, he did not adequately defend himself. He was apologetic and saying, we really don't want to talk about that. That's not what he came here to discuss. What you did was political. Everything in this country says North Korea is a pariah country. You should
right.
not deal with them. Even Richardson was warned, or not warned, was told not to go there. This is a powerful man. By everybody's standards, he was told not to go there. So obviously, the image of North Korea is one of don't deal with them, period. Now, if you choose to deal with them as a basketball player or as Richardson, there is a political act. Now, the idea that you don't want to defend the fact that you bring basketball instead of guns, and at the end of the day, you choose to apologize. Charles Smith could have come back, and this is why a study in Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali was doing it because of himself, and he was doing it before his, you know, integration with the whole Muslim movement. He was his own man, and that's what we need.
Okay, I grant you all of this. I mean, no quarrel with your arguments so far, because they are very sound points mm-hmm. that you're making. But
yes.
let us look at the situation as it evolved. In, you know, in hindsight, we could get really altruistic and we could get very, very, be very clear about what could have been. But let's look at the situation as it unfolded. And that's
uh-huh.
my point. As it unfolded, I'm real clear as to who the culprits are. I'm very clear about that. Even with Rodman losing it, even with the you know, his inability to actually control the situation, even with his complete lack of control over the media and so forth, even with all of that, I am still real clear as to who the culprit is and what the intention was. Now, that he fed into it and that others were not as prepared to deal with the situation, fine. I accept that. But I'm looking at the situation the way it unfolded. And I see that the treatment of Rodman and these men was entirely different from when the Philharmonic went. Okay? It's the same thing. The Philharmonic was advised, you know, this is an evil country with an evil leader. And they said, great, we understand that and we're going. CNN was effusive in praise. The New York Times was effusive in praise about what this did and how wonderful and moving and all this kind of stuff. Really good PR. Did one single violinist get dragged over the coals? Did the oboist have to stand up and defend himself? No, because it was a package deal. The Philharmonic which is a high class thing. Mm-hmm. No, they don't have saxophones in the Philharmonic or any symphony. It's a black instrument. So
the idea that a corporation and institution whose intention from the beginning is to disempower black people, is to misinform people in general. The idea that they would empower and reaffirm your humanity for doing a good deed. I think that they're a media source that anyone would look at as a propaganda source.
Let me ask you this, Eric.
Yes.
Okay. You're talking about media being disempowering and all that. You understand that. Now, if we were to deal with the subject strictly in terms of the relationship between blacks and media, you're clear about how Rodman dealt with media.
Yeah.
How do you explain the blacks within CNN who did the same, who treated Rodman and others the same way?
I explain it by saying that, for me, if Rodman would have been in those people's positions, he would have turned the same way. In the same way we see them turning on each other for doing a good deed, and this is what we have to change. We have to become more humane. These people have to become more humane. So for us to defend the humanity that they're displaying, they're not displaying confidence in themselves or what they did. They're being apologetic. They're being apologetic and they're being disgraceful. You go there drunk. You know, you cannot defend yourself, and the rest of them cannot defend themselves, and then you turn on each other. You know?
But I have to disagree with you now. I'll tell you why.
What do you mean?
I'm going from what happened, not what ought to have happened or what should happen. I'm going with what happened, and we deal with it as in that way. What happened? With all the ugliness and everything else, with Rodman's out of control, I understand all of that. I get it. But I'm dealing with what happened. Now, should it have been handled differently? Fine. Yes. But if, let's say you were asked to, as you are, you're assessing the situation, but you're assessing the situation in a kind of theoretical context, which in a way, I'll have to say, evades the reality of what happened. With all the faults and all the flaws, with everything that happened that was, you know, full of flaws, and every person who was full of flaws, I am still clear. I am absolutely clear about who the culprits are.
My question is, what is the culprit? The culprit is someone that's been doing the same thing consistently over and over again.
Because you go into
an ambush, you know, knowing that this is what they're about.
But understand this: maybe he doesn't know. Maybe Rodman and the others had an entirely different orientation with respect to media and what media can do. Maybe their experiences had not been as intense as this, and so they figured they could handle it. Whatever it is, let me challenge you right now.
Yes.
Is it possible, Eric? You are so brilliant and you're so astute, but is it possible that your critique is itself evading the issue, is itself doing the work that we were trying to analyze, which is to say you blame the victim for what has happened? I see very clearly. I mean, I respect your view, and you are correct. Clara, you are correct about the need for personal responsibility. Ultimately, yes, absolutely. But you know what? We're dealing with the situation as it unfolded, with everything else outside of it. We can always theorize about what should happen. I'm dealing with what was, what the facts as they presented themselves. And I am very clear that whatever missteps that were made by Rodman and anybody else, I am very clear, very, very, very clear that these men were victimized. These men were targets of a concerted effort and a campaign to utterly destroy them. I have no question about that. And if I were to put the priorities on a scale of where I fix my attention, I fix my attention on the deed that was done. The deed that was done was the destruction of these men. And that, to me, is priority number one. That gets my attention more than anything else. Yes, Dennis Rodman and others need to really revisit the situation now, and they really need to learn from this. And all kinds of education should happen. It should ideally have happened before, but I'm not interested right now in what could or should have happened. I'm dealing strictly with the situation that happened. You see, that's where I am. And in that situation, of course, nobody is without fault. And if I were to make a judgment, do I judge the person who was on the receiving end? Do I judge that person on the same level as the person doing harm to that person? No. The person doing harm is the bigger culprit. And we have to see that. Number two, part of what should happen, and it's unfortunate that we are discussing, I think, the responsibility Rodman had in this thing as almost on an equal level with the injury done to him. They're two entirely different things. The injury Rodman did to himself and others in no way measures up on a scale of equality with the level of invective and vitriol and the evil that was meant for them. There's no way we could compare the two. There's no way. That's what I'm thinking, Eric. Are you still there? Eric?
Hello?
Are you there? Yes, we could hardly hear you. But that's my thought. That's my thought.
I'm saying, if this is the case, why do they continue going to Fox and MSNBC or whatever, apologizing?
Look, you're right.
They are feeding the vultures. They are the ones that are
Yes, Eric,
that's all my point. I'm not saying that they're not being attacked. I'm saying, at what point do you at least put up a defense?
Because you know what? Uh-huh. You have to look at it on the other side, and this is true. You can't imagine the intensity of being targeted this way, where you heard one of the players talk about families being concerned about death threats and the safety of their families, and these are huge pressures. And then Dennis Rodman internalizes it. You see, we have to understand what happened here from all kinds of aspects. Here's a guy now, he is bearing the personal responsibility of failure, but not failure that causes consequences just to himself. He's now bearing the responsibility of failure that he believes he caused everybody else. And then there's shame of failure. You know what it is to have unanimity of agreement by an enemy force that is coming after you unrelentingly. They're coming after you because they're going to destroy you, and that's the mission, to destroy you psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, financially, in every way, to absolutely bring your existence, the thing that is meaningful to you, and the thing meaningful to all of these men is basketball and the ability to make a living after retirement. You know, they had their finances exposed. The media just cut them up and diced them up. They had all kinds of awful pressures. No wonder, I'm telling you, I'm surprised that Dennis Rodman is still alive. So we have to see that in as part of the narrative of our existence. If they can't lynch you with a rope, they'll do it in other ways. Why do they go to the media? Because the pressures are so intense that they lose focus. They actually begin to hypothesize and begin to believe that maybe if we sit down and reason with these people, and that only gives more energy to these vultures. But it's an education that will have to happen. What I am saying is, when we have a choice in how we analyze the situation, we always, always, you look at what is happening to the victims, not the people doing the bad deeds. You look at the people absorbing the consequences, and your sympathies have to be with them. That's the best way to deal with it. You put your sympathies with them, and you shore them up, and you surround them, and you bring them into the fold, even if they're unwilling. Even if they don't want your love, you give it, because that is the experience that we have had all along.
If this was a fight, I'll be in the corner of Rodman, Smith, and the rest of them.
It's a fight, Eric. Stop right there. Eric.
I would have them. I mean, this has been my life. I would have them stand up for themselves.
But this is what you would do.
Like, if they could do this to millionaires, you know, everybody else seems like, yeah, you could shoot them down because they can't even stand up for them. They can't even defend themselves. They don't have the words for it. And, you know,
I could tell you this. I could tell you my reaction. I saw me.
Yeah.
This is just me. I saw me in Dennis Rodman. And there is no way, with all the faults, he could have 500 million, thousand, zillion, gazillion faults. It doesn't matter to me in this particular instance that we clearly see what was at work here. And already, how could I put it? An already pulverized man was literally beaten into dust. I can't watch that and then put more blame on him and say,
how do you become so sensitive that just somebody talking nonsense, it will beat us down? We have a history of being beat down.
But understand,
we have a history of being shot down. Somebody talking nonsense is going to beat you down so much that you're tongue-tied? To me, that doesn't even make sense.
But
I'll
tell you what.
If you're going to use your guns and your sticks and show that brutality, then fine. But you're going to talk and all you're spewing is lies and you're going to beat me down with lies? And I'm defenseless against that? Just at some point, I have to look at myself and say, listen, you know, I got to stand up. And this is what Martin Luther King said. A man can't ride your back unless he's bit.
Here's a real life example of the critical choices that have to be made, okay, in terms of how do people proceed along this horizontal plane of life. And what we should do is the number one demand in this situation is compassion for the victim. Whether the victim is responsible for his or her actions, whether the victim caused it, but the fact is that this level of inhumanity directed at them, this vitriol directed at them, the intent to destroy them, compels us even more to be compassionate and in the instant that this is happening, to respond with compassion for the victims. Now, after that, we could sit down in a padded room and get some things straight. But number one is, in the situation, to exercise compassion and show compassion for the people who are the in the bullseye of the media. Those are the people you show compassion for. Now, how they got there, what they did to provoke it, well, all these things are, in my view, in the instant moment that we're looking at it, these things are not the priority. The priority is to be clear about the intent to victimize these people, because somebody decided that that's what they deserved and that's what they organized themselves to deliver, to absolutely destroy them. But this is a really good strong points that you make, and I can't disagree with you on the observations that you make in terms of personal responsibility, in terms of being far more sophisticated about, you know, where have you been? I mean, you've been around the media for all of your professional life. You ought to have known certain things by now. All of these things, to me, are things that should be dealt with separately. Number one is respond quickly and totally with compassion for the victim, and then you deal with the other stuff. Thanks, Eric. Great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Hello, Green from Baltimore. Oh, no, sorry. I'm sorry. In queue, we go to follow the line. DX from L.A.
Hello, Beatrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Well, you guys are intense.
I love this because, you know, this is real talk. You know, this is real talk.
People are not something
masquerading.
I wanted to bring something up today, which I haven't heard you touch on. Maybe you have, but it's about what's going on down in North Carolina. On every Monday, they have something called Moral Mondays. And basically, just a little bit of an explanation is that, I grew up half of my childhood in North Carolina, and North Carolina has always been known as a sort of a moderate state. Sometimes it flips to the red, sometimes to the blue. And, of course, Obama won it in 2008, but Romney barely won it in 2012. So it's one of those wobbler states, kind of a purple state. So what's happened is in the last 4 or 5 years, this multi-billionaire named Pope, who has been called one of the Koch brothers' brother from another mother, Art Pope, he's put a lot of money into politics and this white right-wing agenda, and now he's been able to get so many Republicans elected, and even the governorship has turned to Republican, and they've taken over both state houses and the governor's mansion. And they're instituting all these right-wing policies. One is they're one of the states who voted to not accept the extra Medi-Cal funding, so they've cut they've cut off about 500,000 people, and from Medicare. And they're also cutting funding for AIDS drugs and things like that, and more corporate tax cuts. Well, after this governor, Republican governor, got elected, he appointed Mr. Pope, the billionaire, as the budget director of the state. So in response to this, the people have a movement called Moral Mondays, where every Monday they go and they march up into the state house and they occupy it, sort of like what was going on in Wisconsin at the time. Now, the man who's credited for leading this is Reverend, Reverend William Barber, who is the head of the NAACP chapter in that state. So what they do is they march into the state house and they demonstrate, and sort of like in Wisconsin. Now, it's a good thing. Seems all very positive. I just don't want what happened in Wisconsin and what happened in Egypt to happen here. And what I mean by that is, hope they don't fall for the okey-doke, because what happened in Wisconsin is that they talk the people into getting off the streets and not coming into the Capitol and go back home and wait for a recall election, which an unsuccessful recall election, because what happened was, through whatever means, they were able to keep the governor in there who was instituting all these policies. Now, this in North Carolina looks like a Republican versus Democrat thing. And as we know, the Democrats are not much better than Republicans when it comes to these things. So I just wanted to get your – oh, yeah, and if anyone wants to know any information on this, just Google Moral Mondays. And I suggest Bill Moyer's website, Moyer's and Company. He has a hour-long show on this. So I wanted to get your opinion on this. What's going on down there, if you know anything?
Well, I've been looking at it from an entirely different point of view, and that is from the NAACP leadership point of view. And with that, I've been really in touch with Randy Short, Reverend Randy Short, who has been waging a single-handed campaign almost and getting the word out about it. So he'll be with us very shortly, and we'll get into that particular discussion in a more definitive way. But I've been looking at it, and we'll be talking about it.
Right. Now, when I said that I didn't want the same thing to happen as what happened in Egypt, we recall what happened in Egypt. The people had a real movement going, and then they talked them basically into getting off the street after they overthrew the guy, the original, what
Morsi?
Was his name? Excuse me?
Morsi?
No, he's the one that got elected, but the one that was in there, Mubarak.
Mubarak. Hosni
right?
Mubarak, yes.
When they overthrew him, they talked to people into getting off the street and going back home and waiting to elect someone else. So what happened when they elect this guy, Morsi? Well, for one thing, the military stayed in charge, so some of the old regime's still there. And then the guy starts instituting this, some of the same policies. I mean,
well, of course,
so,
I mean, that's the way it goes.
Right,
when you study, we should do a program, and I should do a series on how things sometimes look spontaneous, but they are actually planned and anticipated outcomes. And that's why people choose to employ a particular strategy, because they know the outcomes. They know exactly what will happen. So we'll deal with that.
I believe the people have to stop.
You know what? We are at the end, though, of the program today, DX.
Okay.
I'm so sorry. But what I will do is, because I see a lot of people online and more on my email, at leadstories@gmail.com, wanting to participate. So tomorrow we will truncate the entire hour. I'll do a small piece, which I don't want to cancel at all tomorrow. And we will use the rest of the program continuing our discussion today. So pardon me for not getting everybody in today, but, you know, it's important that you have your say. So we will do that tomorrow. A very interesting piece tomorrow. We'll take a bit of the program, not all of the program like today, but the rest of the time we will continue the conversation. This is really incredible education, and I value it so much that people have a chance to say what is on their mind and to bring new thoughts so that we can enjoy. Thank you for joining me today, and thank you for your wonderful contributions. Stay tuned. Upcoming is Richard Wolf with Economic Update, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks.